danger is stealing in as relapse comes above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 297 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Melrose, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from Maryland, United States, it's Andrew Brokers. How are you, Andrew?
I'm doing pretty well. It's cold in Maryland, United States. Yeah. I thought we were sort of done. I mean, we've had 80 degree days, I've worn shorts, and now I'm like considering turning the heat on.
Yeah, I was packing up all my winter clothes, but I did not actually take the tubs to the basement, and I'm happy about that because I need some of that now. But you don't have to shovel rain.
Fair enough. And very soon I'm going to be thinking longingly of 50 degree weather because I'm sure it's going to be triple digits in Las Vegas, where I will be in almost exactly a week. I should be getting out there.
It's super excited. I mean,
actually, by the time people are hearing this, like it's going to be, but by the time you're hearing this, I'll probably be in Las Vegas.
Yeah. Please tell me you're excited.
I'm pretty excited. You know, I'm so focused right now on getting the book done. That's just like sort of consuming everything else.
Oh my God. That's going to be so great. Are you trying to get it done before Vegas?
I mean, ideally, I don't think that's going to, part of it is I'm going to be in Vegas a week before, there's even like stuff that I'm particularly interested in starting to play. So you know, it's not going to be done before I get to Vegas. Hopefully it's going to be done before like the actual WSOP starts. I want at least to have like the sort of writing and content part finished. I might still be, you know, kind of waiting to get a cover together, like some little stuff along those lines. But yeah, I want like basically everything substantive that I need to do on it. I'm hoping to have that out of the way before WSOP starts.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, it's good that you are focusing on that. And it's also so hard not to project my own feelings onto you because like if I were working so hard, then like the feeling of touching down in Vegas and having like a big chunk of work behind me, like yeah, I would be so happy. But I think we experience Vegas in different ways.
I agree with that. That's just not going to be my experience. Like I'm going to touch down in Vegas and have been doing chunks of work on the plane and still have big chunks of work ahead of me.
Yeah. Yep. That's right. And you're probably not going to like literally run to a cab and ask to be taken to a poker room. That's
also accurate.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a difference between us. that's not true. I go to the hotel first, drop off my bag so that I don't have to lug a thing to the poker room. Then I pretty much run for a poker room. Shit, this is... I might need to rethink. Anyway.
sorry, Sean. You really want to go to Las Vegas, don't you? No, don't apologize. That doesn't have to come out.
Yeah, it doesn't have to come out, but I may need to discuss this with somebody before I release the episode. That's all right. Okay, good. I will be following your professional development with great interest as a friend.
Thank you. So hopefully we're going to have a guest for folks, but we don't have one lined up yet. And for now, we're just going to get our introduction and our strategy out of the way. Any other introductory material you want to address?
Woo, almost the summer. I'm not even going to Las Vegas, but, you know, PokerGo, they're doing great things. Shout out to Zach Ralston, somewhere out there, I'm sure, doing wonderful things in poker media. And it's exciting. I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, what everybody does, seeing how the World Series shakes out and all that.
Oh, I have a little brag. I had a great lunch last week. I guess it was Friday with Matt Glassman. So he was going to be...
That's a big brag.
Yeah, it was great. He was giving some kind of talk in the Baltimore area, like actually pretty close to Maryland Live, and we met up for, I mean, the only plan was like lunch. We ended up spending like 3 hours just like hanging out and shooting the shit, which was lovely.
Yeah, that sounds really good. It sounds really good. If I know from experience, he's as good at real life as he is at Twitter. So. No, that's great. Shout out to Matt.
And you know, I'm sure I'll see Carlos in Las Vegas. It sounds like I'll get to see editor Sean Lango in Las Vegas. You know, a lot of our former guests, I actually went out of my way. I've met Jamie Kerstetter in person. I've never really like hung out with her. I actually declined an opportunity, and this is like probably my biggest non-poker regret from last summer. It was coming into, it must have been the closer. It was like one of the two WSOP events that I did really well in last summer. And I'm pretty sure it was the second of which would be the closer, obviously. So it was like coming into day two of the closer, and I don't even remember who else was with her. There was a few other people I was also interested in like getting to know better, but I ran into Jamie Kerstetter with a few people, and they were getting, it was like after day one, really, we just bagged for day one. Day two is going to be the next day. And they're going to be going out for margaritas, and she's like, oh, you should come with us. And I mean, obviously, like, you don't turn down an opportunity to hang out with Jamie Kerstetter.
No.
But I was also like, I had a lot of chips going on to day two, and like I wanted to rest and not have drinks. So I did, I think, the responsible thing and declined. But it felt crappy. And
yeah, it's funny.
Debating the whole way back to my car, I was like, should you just run back and catch up with them? So I already reached out to Jamie, and I was like, it has to be a priority this year that we're going to hang out. So hopefully we are, and I'll get to hang out with her a bit and probably meet some of or meet again some of our other former podcast guests.
Yeah, it's funny because my mental model of your psychology, or your like poker world psychology, that's like the immovable post meets infinitely strong, you know, cannonball or whatever of what I think. It's like getting to hang out with Jamie Kerstetter versus like being a responsible grumpy old man about your sleep, when, especially like when you actually have chips and are going into day two. It's like, yeah, I'm not sure how you made that decision. I'm not sure how your brain didn't just explode, is what I'm saying.
I mean, I think I knew it was the right thing to do at the time, but it didn't feel good. Our strategy sponsor is Tournament Poker Edge. If you're going to be playing any of the WSOP this summer, or if you are interested in seeing some of my, and I'm sure other people's hands and experiences from the World Series of Poker, or even if you're just looking to improve your tournament poker game for reasons that have nothing whatsoever to do with the World Series of Poker, Tournament Poker Edge is an excellent resource for you. For as little as $25 a month, you'll get access to dozens, probably even over 100 videos from me, hundreds of videos from other instructors, all for as little as $25 a month, and you can sign up at tournamentpokeredge.com. We have a strategy hand today that is coming to us from Chris. Chris played this hand in a 2-5 game at Turning Stone. We're six-handed, he says, which is usually my cue to stand up. However, these players are quintessential townies. They're more interested in their conversation than my growing stack. Until this hand. As the dealer throws us cards, the guy to my left mentions that I haven't said much all night. I am referring to Chris. I look down at pocket jacks under the gun. This is under the gun at a six-handed table. I have $950, Villain under the gun 1 has $450, and Big Blind, who has shown down trash cards after big preflop bets several times, has $700. So our hero is under the gun, six-handed. He's perceived as tight, apparently, by the player on his immediate left, and he has pocket jacks in a 2-5 game. he ends up opening to $10, which I tend to be, you know, I don't often want to focus a lot on like preflop bet sizing stuff. I don't think it matters terribly much. I think though that there probably are some reasons to raise more than the minimum. And let me give you his reasons first so that we can discuss this. So he says, I thought about opening larger. Since the rest of the table has played mostly tight, I wanted to induce a call or raise from the loose big blind. This might be my first mistake, but I was trying to play exploitively. Thoughts on the preflop raise size?
I first thought is like, oh, I remember playing at least one session with you, but I think several sessions. I remember when you were experimenting with doing this exclusively, like only doing min raising before the flop. That was like years ago now. So that's my first thing. It's like, Andrew knows more about the trade-offs of min raising before the flop than I do, because he was a professional poker player doing it exclusively for a long time and thinking about it very hard. So that's my first thought, is that like, you know more about this than I do. My second thought is like, no, just raise more. Like, A, even if people think you're tight, that doesn't mean they're going to fold. And B, like, inducing a call isn't good if the call you induce is correct. So, and it's not that good if the call you induce is only slightly incorrect. So I would just make it a standard size here.
Yeah, I think you want to be making it 15 or 20. What you said really is the most important thing, Nate. You're like, the big blind is not going to be making a mistake if he peels. And it sounds like, I mean, you say that he's been showing down bad hands to raises already. Like, it doesn't sound like you need to min raise to induce him to make mistaken calls. And his calls are going to be bigger mistakes if you make larger raises. Like, if he peels here with queen five suited when you've only min raised, that's not really a mistake. I mean, it doesn't sound great, but yeah, I mean, he's getting a pretty good price. He does, I mean, against your actual hand, he certainly has the right price to be continuing. He's probably going to play reasonably well against your actual hand, which is to say he's not going to play a huge pot just because he flops a pair of fives. He will put money in the pot correctly when he flops a pair of queens. Now, if you get really lucky and you get like a queen, jack, five kind of board short, then you're happy that he called pre-flop, but that's a hell of a lot to ask for. And, you know, if he flops a flush draw, even that could end up being bad for you. You know, let's suppose the board is ace high with a flush draw and you bet and he check raises, or you check behind and then he bets the turn and river. You know, there's a number of ways that this can go badly for you, even if he doesn't actually improve to beat you. You know, there's very few hands where you are really welcoming action for a minimum raise, especially welcoming action from the big blind, or even a hand as strong as jacks. It's not necessarily that great for you to get peeled by the big blind, or to get peeled by a player who has position on you, like under the gun one here, who's going to end up being our main villain. So I mean, I think there's a number of reasons to raise larger. The biggest one being, as you said, Nate, a lot of people are just going to play the hands they're going to play kind of regardless of your raise size. And that's going to be more of a mistake if you make a larger raise.
Yep.
Anyway, our hero min raises to $10 and ends up getting called by under the gun one and the big blind. So we go to the flop, which is jack five deuce rainbow. Our hero flops top set for the nuts. There's $32 in the pot. Big blind checks. What do you want to do now?
So what am I doing with my range here? Well, with my range, I'm betting a lot, but not always. So there are some obvious reasons to choose top set on a jack five deuce board as a slow playing hand. The most important is that you have the deck crippled. Like, there's one straight draw. There are no flush draws. The straight draw is unlikely because it requires having exactly 4-3. And you can be Chris from last week and, you know, get nailed by 4-3 offsuit, but that doesn't actually happen that often. So, like, you know, you completely got the deck crippled. Now, having the nuts is a bad reason in itself to check. I'm not saying we should check. I'm saying, like, one of those traditional reasons actually does apply here. That said, I'm betting this flop a lot, like, really a lot. So big blind would have peeled with any number of things. I think it's not that hard to get peeled by ace high here, even if, like, some random person at the table says, oh, you're tight. That doesn't mean somebody's just folding ace-queen here if you bet. You know, and it's possible to pair the five, and it's possible for them to have a pocket pair and all those other things. And, like, also, like, precisely because it's pretty hard for them to have anything, if I'm the preflop raiser, I'm going to be betting here so, so much. It's actually, especially given that I'm min-raised before the flop, I could have very nearly or literally a 100% betting range here. And if I've got 100% betting range here, I should probably have, you know, every hand in that range. So I bet. So I think I'm betting. I would say I would bet the same amount I would bet with other hands, which would be $15. Online, I might bet, you know, $13.75 or something. But, you know, live, I would pick up three red chips and I would put them in front of the betting line. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think everything you say makes sense. The question here really is, like, just how exploitive do you want to be? So the argument about, you know, that you're going to bet almost anything here might have something to do with some assumptions about the board texture and the hand, the ranges that your opponents are playing preflop and how they're going to respond to a bet on this board. You know, like, one thing that you'll often find with you know, townies, as Chris puts it, or, you know, people who are not real serious, sophisticated poker players, is they like to play a lot of hands pre-flop. And this is, you know, Ed Miller calls this playing poker like it's a slot machine. You know, they want to play a lot of hands pre-flop and just see whether they hit flops. They're not really thinking in terms of, like, expected value or minimum defense frequencies or, like, any of this other stuff. They're just like, they get a pretty hand pre-flop and they want to call and see if they connect with the flop. And then if they don't connect with the flop, they don't really think that hard about whether you might be bluffing or whether they should try to, like, rebluff you or anything along those lines. They just fold if they don't get any connection with the board. So Jack 5 Deuce is a board that those kinds of players are not going to connect with very often. Right? Even loose players pre-flop fold a lot of hands that have a five or a deuce in them. You can be pretty sure no one has a jack since you've got most of those accounted for. So players who are really, you know, focused on just getting a piece on the piece of the board and not, like, evaluating a situation are going to fold an awful lot in this spot. And that's good for you. Even when you don't block the jack, that's good for you. Like, even if you're just betting here with 10-9 suited or something, like, you're happy to get all those folds and they're not going to have a jack all that often. So there's good reasons why against that sort of player you might just bet here with anything that you opened pre-flop when you actually want folds. When you have top set, I do think there could be a pretty strong exploitive case for checking. I think if you were looking at this with, like, a solver kind of approach, you don't see the nuts get slow played very often. Even on boards where the hero doesn't have a high checking frequency, the hands like top set tend to be, like, the most frequently aggressively played hands. But that's going to be, like, Poker Snowy is going to be making an assumption that under the gun one's range is much stronger than it probably actually is. Like, he's going to be, like, Poker Snowy is going to be thinking that under the gun one needs a pretty good hand to cold call an under the gun raise when his own position is bad. And that's probably not how your real life under the gun one opponent is thinking or is approaching his decision. So I don't think that the slow playing or the checking is necessarily a problem here, but I think you should be very clear on what you're trying to accomplish because you're checking. And I think this is where, Chris does end up checking, and I'll give you his reasoning here. He says, I'm clearly ahead of both ranges here with my set, and no turn on the board changes that. Big blind could show up with anything, so I guess I shouldn't discount a few backdoor straight draws, but if he gets there in his range with any of those, it's just a bad beat. I don't see a loose big blind player not three betting with pocket queens, kings, or aces, and I learn more about villain by checking, so I check. So I think he's doing a good job of kind of articulating why he doesn't have a great value target right now. You know, he's ruling out the hands that he'd really like the opponent to have, like an overpair to the board. Those don't seem too likely. I think at least implicitly he's, you know, ruling out top pair, which is another hand that, you know, he would really like someone to have. And so recognizing that there's not a good value target right now is, like, the first step towards building a case for slow playing. The other things that I would like to hear Chris talk about are how checking might create a good value target later. And I do think there's a strong case for this, right? So, you know, a queen, king, or ace could peel off, and those could all transform a hand that previously looked like a complete whiff on this board in an opponent's eyes into a hand that opponent is now ready to play a relatively large pot with, and that would be very good for you. I also think it would be worthwhile to think a little bit about what you yourself are representing when you check here. You know, as you say, Nate, you're going to be betting quite a lot of hands. And I think one of the problems that people run into with slow playing, especially when they just do it in a sort of decision point by decision point kind of process without thinking about an overall plan or considering what they're representing, is checking the flop initially is real tricky. And people, you know, don't expect that you're going to have a good hand when you check the flop. The problem is, after checking the flop, you're going to have to put money in the pot at some point. And that's when the jig tends to be up. So, okay, you check the flop. It looks like you have a weak hand. Somebody bets. What would a weak hand do? A weak hand would fold. But that's not what you're going to do when you have pocket jacks. You're going to have to call or you're going to have to raise. And both of those things are going to look suspicious. So you have to weigh that against, I mean, yeah, you're going to get a lot of folds when you bet the flop, but betting the flop is also consistent with how you'd actually play a lot of weak hands. Once you do something different, like once you check and raise or once you check and call, even to an opponent who's not paying a lot of attention, I think that's going to send up some red flags. And so you have to think about, what am I trying to convince people I have if I check and call the flop, which is what ends up happening. Check under the gun one, bets $25 into the $32 pot, big blind folds. Chris says straightforward call. I'm not sure I agree with that. I think calling and raising are both pretty viable options here. I mean, I understand the reluctance to raise because it's going to look very strong, but I think calling also looks very strong. Like, you can't really avoid looking strong at this point.
Yeah, I mean, this is one thing we've talked about kind of a lot. Like, I really like check raising in spots like this sometimes, like with a hand like ace-queen, especially in tournaments, especially against townies, because, like, you check and then, like, what are they, like, they bet. What do they probably have? Like, a hand, like, probably pocket sevens. Or Jack 10 or something. Like, then you raise and they think, like, fuck you. And they call. Then you bet again on the turn and they fold because you could have something better than they. Like, it's just, I don't know. Like, your opponent is very capped here, I think. I mean, it's not true. He could have, like, fives or deuces. But I think a lot of the hands your opponent has are just not going to put that much money. But yeah, I think there's a case to be made for raising the flop. And you do, like, if you want to win a big pot, you're going to have to put money into it at some point. Maybe that time is now.
Yeah, that's a good summary. Chris calls, which I think is also okay. I mean, I would think at this point, by checking and calling, you're representing some kind of marginal hand with a decent amount of showdown value, but that's not interested in playing a large hand on this pot, on this board. That might be like ace king or ace queen, which, as you said, I mean, those could be viable check raises. Those could also be viable check calls, where you just, well, you know, you can beat a bluff if when you have ace king or when you have ace queen, and you have outs if your opponent's not bluffing. Your hands like pocket tens and pocket nines are the kinds of hands that might check call on this board. You know, I think to an opponent who, and I realize you're not expecting these opponents to be doing like the world's greatest hand reading, but I still think they're gonna, like, this is gonna be suspicious enough that there's gonna be something going through their head in terms of what does it seem like this player has. I don't think that's unreasonable to think that, you know, there's some amount of thought, even if it's at an unconscious level or subconscious level, is you know, your hand is kind of gonna look like tens, nines, ace king, ace queen, which is okay. That's not the end of the world. So you call. There's $82 in the pot, and the turn is a six. So the board now is Jack 5, Deuce 6. The full rainbow is on the board, so we've got no flush draws. Our hero is holding pocket jacks. And Chris says, I consider betting. I probably should have. This card doesn't improve his range, which I peg at broadways, loaded mid pairs, and a couple suited straight draws. He bet into me first, and I'm willing to let him keep doing that since this board is awful for most of my range. I check. I do think we want to check at this point. I don't really think there's a case for checking and calling and then dunking a pretty random turn card like this one. The way I often encourage people to think about this is any hand, like, so, I mean, dunk betting, meaning betting into the player who's the aggressor on the previous street, should by definition be a thing that you do rarely. It should be only when the board, like when the new card that comes or the new cards that come like kind of dramatically change the board texture in some way. So like if the turn were a jack or the turn were an ace, those are cards that are pretty dramatic changes to the board, and you might have a Donk Betting Range on those cards. I don't think a six is really that dramatic of a change to the board. I mean, I guess it completes 3-4, but that's not really a hand that's likely to be in your range anyway. So if you're just thinking I should have Donk Bet like any random turn card, just, you know, just like whatever the turn is, I should be donk betting it. That's really a case for check raising. I mean, a check raise is basically the same thing as check calling and then donking any turn, right? Either way, you're putting the same amount of money in the pot in sort of the same way. The only difference is that when you check call and then bet any turn, you're letting your opponent see the turn card, whereas when you check raise the flop, you're putting the same amount of money in the pot without letting him see the turn card. All things equal, you'd rather not let him see the turn card. So I think that, you know, your play so far has been consistent with you having ace king, ace queen, pocket tens, pocket nines. Those are hands that would check the turn. I think you check the turn with this hand also.
Well said.
Thank you. The villain bets $50 into the $82 pot. What now?
I'd probably raise. I mean, he bet, I don't know, that size is certainly consistent with value. It's consistent with something that could get skeptical if you raise. You know, 5-6 improved, he's allowed to have a set. If he had pocket eights, he might just check behind. You know, there are also some hands, like, if he folds, sometimes he's folding away equity. It's not really what you want to happen, but a fold is certainly not all bad for you. So, I mean, I would raise, and I would try to get stacks in by the river. You know, roughly 165 seems like something that would set up a stack that he would have a hard time. Yeah, that seems about right. That would leave him, you know, it would be hard for him to fold a big hand on the river to that sizing, I think. So I would raise. What do you think?
I can see it going either way. And I think this is another point where a little bit more planning would be a big help here. So now we have to make a choice of whether we're kind of trying to induce bluffs, which we would best do by calling, or whether we're trying to induce, I guess, essentially bluff catches, like whether we're trying to get the villain to get skeptical, which a check raising could induce. Given this player's comments that you've been tight and how strong, like, I think a check raise here might get a different reaction for one of us, especially if you're wearing your floppy hat,
Nate, yeah.
Then it might for Chris, given the way that he's set his perception. I mean, in general, I think this is a really strong line. Just like, I mean, setting any kind of like game theory aside, just like empirically based on how people actually play, the like check call flop, check raise turn as the pre-flop raiser is a line many people have difficulty balancing with bluffs.
Yep.
And I don't know that your, you know, random townie opponent is going to articulate it in exactly that way, but if he's played some poker, he has probably had that experience of people tend to have strong hands when they do this.
Yep.
So I think you could raise a lot of red flags this way. And a lot of the hands that you mentioned, Nate, are hands where raising the turn may not be that essential. Like if he does have a set or he does have two pair, I don't think you're giving up that much by just checking and calling the turn. He's probably going to value bet most rivers anyway. He may have difficulty folding to a raise once he does that. I don't think you're giving up that much by not raising the turn against those hands.
Yeah.
The question really is like, what are the hands that might be betting now, but then, you know, check back the river, but you could prevent them from doing that by taking the lead away and making the pot a little bit larger now. I mean, maybe it would be stuff like pocket tens, pocket nines, pocket eights, and then he just sort of, you know, gets skeptical and doesn't want to fold when you check raise. I mean, that's so like that, I think that's the kind of thing you have to consider before you raise, is not just I want to get stacks in, but really thinking about what are the hands where it's going to make a difference whether or not I raise. I think the advantage of calling is that if the villain is just kind of like firing away because it looks like you have some kind of marginal hand, you want to give him room to keep doing that. And once you raise, he's probably just going to give up with all of his bluffs. I think bluffs are a lot more likely at this point. That like I think there's only a, there's a pretty small number of hands that I think could really legitimately be betting for value and consider paying off a check raise. And I think given how you've played the hand so far, it looks a lot like you have a marginal bluff catchy kind of hand. It's a lot easier for the villain to have, you know, to just be sort of like running some big bluff. And if he has a hand that's going to pay off a check raise, I think there's a decent chance he's going to bet again on the river anyway. So I think I've sort of talked myself into preferring calling to raising.
Yeah, that's well said. I'll say part of what was behind my initial thought is not thinking that a lot of these townie types are going to run triple barrel bluffs like for fun in the spot. Like, but
yeah.
But, like, are they also going to call down with pocket eights? Like, probably not. So, you know, that's that. Now that I've heard you talk, I probably just call, but could go either way. Could go either way.
And I think if he has, like, a 9-8 suited, I mean, I agree the triple barrel is not always in these guys' arsenals, but at the same time, I mean, checking back the river, yeah, like, he gets to the river with 9 high, no hope.
Yeah.
I mean,
you're right.
It's the kind of situation where people, you know, step out of their comfort zones.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right.
Anyway, Chris says, I think my mistake here is going for a stack. As I just said, this board is awful for most of my range. It's also awful for most of his. Should I have called and let him barrel again? I don't know what river I'm supposed to be afraid of. I check raised to $110. He folded. At least I took down the pot. How much value do you guys think I left on the table? Probably not a lot. I mean, the sad truth of poker is like you don't always win that much when you have great hands like these. You know, when you have a really strong hand, like a lot of your strongest hands, they end up blocking the board in this kind of way. Like often when you have pocket aces, you'd rather not flop a set. You know, like that's a pretty common situation where you're like, oh, crap, I flopped a set. Right. And I mean, I think this is a little bit of the same. I mean, there's many worse boards for jacks than this, but you know, you'd probably rather have a 10-5 deuce flop than a jack 5 deuce flop when you have pocket jacks. At least with, you know, with this kind of stack depth in these opponents. So, I mean, there might just not have been a thing you could have done to win any more than you did. Like maybe the villain just had nothing and you induced him to put two bluffs into the pot and he wasn't going to put a third one in anyway. So it didn't really matter that you raised. Like just because you didn't get the result that you wanted doesn't mean that you did anything wrong or that there would have been a better. I mean, if your opponent just didn't have a hand, he didn't have a hand, then there's not a lot that that you were going to do to change that. That said, I mean, I guess we've tried to address some of what I think are like the areas to improve in terms of how you're thinking through these decisions. And I do think I'm not even sure what the question really means. Like, what river am I supposed to be afraid of? Like, the reason to check and call, I don't think would really have anything to do with being afraid of a particular river. It would be more just to give him room to bluff again, or maybe to improve, if he is bluffing, to improve his hand to the point where he might be, if he's bluffing with like king, queen, you know, give him a chance to river a king or a queen, and maybe you can get paid some more. The other thing that jumped out at me is when he says, this board is awful for most of my range, it's also awful for most of his range. Well, I mean, if there's only two of you, it can't be awful for both of your ranges. Like, it's a zero-sum game. So I think really it's kind of because you're starting with the stronger range, probably. You know, if you're a tight pre-flop raiser and he's a sort of, you know, splashy guy who just called pre-flop, your range doesn't need improvement. Like, you're already starting with the stronger range. So a board that doesn't explicitly help his range, right? A board that's bad for him is by definition going to be good for you. Like, when he calls preflop, he needs help. And this board is not really giving it to him. So, like, this is a pretty good board when you have ace-king. This is a pretty good board when you have pocket 10s or 9s. It may not be quite as good as some, but it's like this is probably an above-average board for ace-king. And I think maybe that's some of the misunderstanding here when you say, you know, the board is awful for my range or something like that. I think like you have a range pre-flop that didn't really need improvement. Even your ace king doesn't need improvement. It's very often ahead. Yeah, maybe that's a bit of an aside, but that was something that jumped out at me.
Yep. Me too.
Any other comments here, Nate?
No, I think you covered it really well. And, you know, as we talked about last week, they don't always have 4-3 on these boards. So you know, let this be proof of that.
Thanks for writing, Chris. Thanks for listening. Thank the rest of you for listening. If you would like to write to us, podcast@thinkingpoker.net, maybe you'll have a chance for us to tell you what's wrong with your thought process. Thousands of listeners. But we only identify you by your first name, so somewhere out there someone's laughing at Chris in their name. Hey everybody, Andrew here with a quick update. Good news and bad news. I'll start with the bad news. I don't have a guest for this week, and actually what you've heard is just about it for this episode. Nate and I recorded that about 2 weeks ago. We've both been quite busy since then, and the good news is I've been busy with finishing up my book, which actually, I don't want to jinx anything, but I think should be out this week. So I'll have more details on Twitter and on next week's podcast about when you can pick that up. I believe what's going to be the case is that if you want a paper version, that's going to be available only through Amazon. You won't be able to get that at nickcast.com. For ebook versions, Kindle will be the only ebook version available through Amazon. So you can get Kindle or paper on Amazon. And if you want other ebook formats, including Kindle, you'll be able to get those from nickcast.com. But yeah, I've been grinding hard on the book and just have not had time to line up a guest. Also, I am in Las Vegas now, all settled. I'll be starting in on my summer grind pretty soon. But yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot of poker players out here right now, so hopefully I'll be able to score some interesting in-person interviews in between my time at the tables. I will keep you posted on the book. I hope you all are excited about it. I certainly am. Tapping on my window pane, feeling faint, feeling ashamed, spread too thin and hoping for a synonym for a word that could take away the pain. Sleepless nights, do I need some kind or the devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign up?